Channel 2 Talk Radio. Channel Radio News Update.
The Royal Bank of Scotland has announced plans to close hundreds of branches, which will result in redundancies. RBS is to close 62, NatWest 197. Around 680 people will lose their jobs. MPs say they have doubts issues surrounding the Irish border can be resolved after Brexit. The government has already said it doesn't want a hard border introduced. In a report, a committee says it can't see how it would be possible to avoid one. A man has been convicted of a murder from 1968. David Dearlove had denied killing 19-month-old Pooh Booth at the house in Stockton-on-Tees in 1968. Dearlove was also convicted of child cruelty charges and will be sentenced later. The judge warned him he faced a mandatory life term. And Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have arrived in Nottingham. It's their first public appearance since announcing their engagement would be taking place. That happened on Monday.
You must have wondered if you ever had PPI. With an estimated 45 million policies sold, chances are you did. But you're just not sure, and you don't know where the paperwork is. So despite the PPI deadline, you probably won't get around to checking. Which is a shame, because the claims guys make it so easy. All you have to do is text EXPERT to 60777, and they'll do a free search to discover if you ever did have PPI. You don't even need the paperwork. Text EXPERT to 60777 now.
The claims guys.
Money Talk with Simon Webster on Channel Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Money Talk. This is Simon Webster. I'm here with Dermot Campbell from Cuba Ventures. Good afternoon, Dermot.
Good afternoon, Simon.
We're going to be talking most of the show about enterprise investment schemes. We'll come to that in a minute. First, a bit of housekeeping as we always go out. Those of you that are regular listeners will have worked out that Channel Radio has been playing with its website. The talk radio session is now on Channel 2. So if you go to the Channel Radio website at channelradio.co.uk, look around for Channel 2 and you'll find us there. If you have a look around that page, you will find Listen Again. And that has got all the previous week's shows, all the previous week's content listed by presenter. So mine is Simon Webster, and by show name, and then you'll see Money Talk there as well. So if you have to leave halfway through and want to hear the rest of the show, that's where you pick it up. And in fact, one of the things you can do is just download the show afterwards and put it on your phone and listen to it in the car, which is how I find out how well or badly I did the previous week. It's always good fun. Money Talk has got its own website at moneytalk.guru. We're on Twitter at moneytalk_guru, hashtag MTRadioUK. There you go. You can't say fairer than that. So much has been happening recently. I mean, I actually found out about the NatWest and RBS redundancies same time you did, dear listener, on the news just now, because I missed that. Dermot was going nodding, so you'd obviously had the radio, the news on the way down.
I saw it in the paper this morning, but yes.
It's a sad fact that the face-to-face service industries are sort of being contracted by the power of the internet, and people are doing so much more online. They're putting their investments on platforms, something you know a lot about and we'll be talking about later. Dermot is nodding. It doesn't work very well on the radio, but yeah. Most of us bank online. I think the only three times I've been in my own bank branch in the last 2 years, two of them I've ended up so frustrated, I've stormed out because there've been massive queues and lots of hassle and aggravation. So it's really, really hard for the banks to work out how to interact with their customers. And it's just such a tragedy for all those high-skilled people that are working in these branches. They're saying they're going to try and make sure there's no compulsory redundancies, but I can't see them avoiding a few, and that will be such a shame. I feel very sorry. So if you work for NatWest or RBS, our sympathy to you today. Let's hope they manage to sort it out so that they can redeploy you in other areas of the business. Now, Dermot, EIS was sort of the big idea in the budget that nobody really picked up on. And it seems like Spreadsheet Phil has got his eye on EIS as a way of funding enterprise going forward. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. He's introduced a major stimulus to encourage investment in small businesses. We were already very good at funding small businesses, but we've given ourselves an absolutely massive opportunity here to get some serious economic growth out of it.
Well, that is very encouraging because, of course, with Brexit looming large over just about everything and nobody knowing what the hell is going on. I mean, the latest one, first of all, it was the size of the divorce bill, which they seem to have squared away, and it's a very large number. The next hurdle is the Irish border, which was always going to be challenging. We really need to do something to make sure that our economy does not go into recession when we start putting up walls with our largest trading partners. We won't go there. It's a long-standing joke on Channel Radio that Paul Andrews was a prolific Brexiteer, whereas I was a reluctant Remainer. And we actually had some fairly respectable debates where we managed not to hit each other or swear or get cross because we both had a sensible point of view and were able to argue it logically. We sort of agree to differ, but it looks like it's going to happen. Anyway, we can't get away from Brexit, but today we are going to focus on EIS. But I want to start going right back the beginning, though, because when we were talking in the green room, our green room is a stand by the coffee machine, but hey-ho, we were talking by the green room before we came on air. Dermot, you're a former airline pilot. How did that work? Well, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to be CEO of an EIS platform company? It's an interesting journey.
It is. I think the world's a slightly safer place now that my feet are firmly on the ground rather than in the air. So we'll enough said there. I gave up flying in 1991 when Air Europe went bust.
All right. Okay.
Along with quite a few other people.
So what did you fly?
I flew something called Short 360s. They were the twin engine things, also known as a shed.
All right.
That flew people down to the Channel Islands and to places like Rotterdam and Amsterdam. Then briefly up the east coast of Britain, taking oil workers to nice places like Hull and Teesside and Norwich and places like that.
All right, okay. And how many people sat in a short 360 shed?
In the shorts, we carried 35 people.
Right.
And I had a brief stint on the Fokker Friendship.
It's slightly bigger, isn't it?
It's slightly bigger, 50 seats.
Yeah.
And that was what we ran a bus service up the east coast of Britain on.
So you did all that, and then you became a financial advisor. Have I got that right?
I did. Yeah.
So what was the attraction? What moved you from airline pilot to financial advice? How did you come to make that transition? It's an interesting story.
Yeah, by like many financial advisors back then, and many people who became financial advisors by mistake.
Yeah, that was me.
I kind of wanted to. I kind of had a dream in my head that I wanted to be in the city when I was at school. Mm. But I also had a dream that I wanted to be a pilot. And then when I lost my job as a pilot, I thought, well, maybe I can become both because pilots are busy in the summer and financial advisors are quiet in the summer, and financial advisors are busy in the winter and pilots are quiet in the winter. But I never quite got back round to going back to flying because actually it's quite a full-time job all the year round.
It is, isn't it? As I discovered, it's very interesting actually. The number of financial advisors I've spoken to is rarely used to be the case actually. Rarely used to be anybody's first choice career. I'm a failed chartered accountant. That's my background. And when I joined Sun Life of Canada in 1982, my mother described it as the worst day of her life. Her opinion improved somewhat when I kept going away on overseas conventions with bits and pieces and actually ended up making a reasonable career of it. And then I set my own business up and she thought I was suddenly respectable. So she was able to tell people what I did for a living. But until then, she was not a happy lady, which was which was always a bit of a bone of contention in the family. So you became an IFA. So how did you get from that to running a platform business?
So I spent about 7 years working for a West End IFA.
Mm-hmm.
I then moved jobs and to a city IFA
mm-hmm.
Called Scott Goodman Harris. And Scott Goodman Harris got bought by UBS in 2004. Got a job on the wealth planning team where I was responsible for tax efficient investments.
Okay.
I did that for about 4 years, and then we decided that we didn't really like tax efficient investments anymore, And I moved over to run the client management team of the intermediary business.
All right, okay.
I then left UBS in 2012, having done 7 years there, which felt like a reasonably decent stint.
Yes, it is.
And a friend of mine had had a project underway, which he'd named Cuba. And he asked me to come in and sort of turn that project into a business.
All right.
Along with one of my former colleagues from UBS. So the two of us set it up. We didn't actually set it up. We just kind of formed it, if you like.
Inherited the idea and turned the project into reality.
We probably took about a 6 month pregnant idea and turned it into a living being.
Wow. That was quite a leap.
Yes, it was. Then in 2013, I did a management buy-in. The original investor has now gone, and we've really gone from strength to strength.
So, all right. So, Cuba Ventures is, if I've got this right, an EIS platform. Is that
well, it's a tax-efficient investment platform. We do other things as well as EIS. EIS is by far the largest thing we do.
Okay.
We also do some inheritance tax-efficient investments. We do seed EIS. We're looking at something called social investment tax relief, which is similar to EIS, but aimed at community projects.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking to add VCTs in the future, venture capital trusts. And anything else which comes along. So
now the world is full of acronyms, and Joe Public and me come to that. Well, I represent Joe Public as I sit in this seat. Get very confused with this. We've talked about EIS, Enterprise Investment Scheme. What is it?
So Enterprise Investment Scheme is a tax incentive to encourage people to invest in small to medium sized businesses.
Okay.
It's extremely difficult to raise money as an entrepreneur, and I can tell you I have first-hand knowledge of that.
Yes, because you had to raise money for your management buy-in.
I had to raise money for that, and I've had to raise money to grow the business since.
Yeah.
It is very, very difficult to raise money.
Yeah.
And it's very expensive. You and I both know it's extremely expensive to run a business.
Tell me about it.
So the Enterprise Investment Scheme is part of a wider group of schemes called the venture capital schemes.
Yep.
They broadly include enterprise investment schemes, or EIS, as we'll talk to them about, and venture capital trusts, or VCTs.
Okay.
And they're both incentives to invest in small companies.
All right. And it's actually really important for listeners who perhaps don't play in this market very much to understand. There is a huge amount of public chatter, I think I'm going to call it chatter, about tax evasion, tax avoidance, jobs for the boys, rich people taking the mickey, and all this sort of stuff. And when we talk about this as financial advice professionals or service providers in that space, and I'm going to bracket you in that one, Dermot, if I may, for the purposes of this little rant, I get very frustrated. Because if you have an ISA, an individual savings account, you can put some money in that. You as a husband can put £20,000 in. Your wife or partner can put £20,000 in. And you pay no tax on the gains and you pay no tax on the income. That is tax avoidance, effectively. And it's totally legal. And the government encourages you to do it. Everybody can do it. It's perfectly legitimate. It's perfectly respectable. There is nothing wrong with it. It is a form. It's a government-sponsored, government-set-up arrangement to allow and encourage people to save money. It's a savings incentive. And the same thing applies for pensions. That's the other big one. Anybody who is benefited from a pension enjoys huge tax benefits. You get top slicing tax relief on your contributions, which means tax relief at the highest rate you pay, which for a lot of people, if you're lucky enough to be earning between £100,000 and £120,000, it's 60%, which a lot of people don't realise. So you get up to 60% tax relief on your contributions. You then get growth in tax refund, and you can take 25% of the fund tax free. That is all tax that you have avoided. And it's perfectly legal, and the government wants you to do it because they want to incentivize you to save for your dotage so they don't have to pay money out in benefits going forward. The same thing is the government wishes to stimulate investment into small business to avoid us falling off a cliff edge as a country going forward, and they desperately need to encourage as many people as they can, be they very, very wealthy or just average people as well. And we're going to come on to the fact that actually there's a market for average investors to hold some EIS investments, something I know that Dermot is very passionate about, and we'll get to that in a minute, where the government is very keen to stimulate people putting money into smaller companies, and as such, they give fairly significant tax breaks to such investors to encourage you to have a play. Have I got that about right? It was a long rant.
That was a long rant, but you've got it absolutely spot on.
I'm going to take that one to the bank. Thank you very much indeed. That's some approbation. So we've got that bit right. So the government's provided enterprise investment schemes to encourage people to invest in smaller companies, and you set up Kuba Ventures as a project to be involved in that space. So what does Kuba actually do?
So the big problem that you as a wealth manager have is that enterprise investment schemes are actually very difficult things for you to invest in. It's all manual. It requires a lot of due diligence, which isn't central to what you do every day.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it isn't central to you to what you do with 90% of your life.
Mm.
And most of what you do is digital. So mostly when you sit down and make an investment, you use some kind of electronic process to do that.
A bit like we do our banking, and we were talking about earlier when we were mentioning RBS and NatWest.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And there is a whole suite of regulation, and we touched on this earlier in the green room, which is designed to make sure that you do your job well and effectively. But in order to meet that regulation, you have to be very, very, very efficient in everything you do. You do not have time to spend reading through manual books of paper for an investment, which is really quite small. And so the platform is there to make that process extremely easy and efficient for you. You don't want to have to ring up 15 different companies to get 15 different valuations for your clients so that you can do that massive calculation that you have to do to see if their portfolios are performing okay. You want all of that information from one place, and ideally you want it fed into your systems electronically so you don't have to ring up anybody. It's just there for you.
And I think as we come up to our first break, it's probably a good point to make that Dermot was making to me earlier. One of the things that Joe Public and a lot of financial advisors seem to get a bit confused about is the fact that EIS is primarily investments into individual trading companies. You might buy a portfolio of those companies, but it's still primarily an investment into an individual trading company. And from an investor's point of view, from a financial advisor's point of view, you need to actually research that company or cause that research to be done and understand exactly what the nuts and bolts are and what the chances are of you getting your money back with a profit. And you need to do that. It is not about buying a fund. So in other words, if you buy an individual investment, you've got all your risk focused in the future of one business. I would regard that as being a fairly high risk punt. And neither Dermot nor I would advocate that type of investment. You want to invest in a portfolio of different companies, different businesses, and therefore spread your risks. As my old mum always used to say, don't put all your eggs in one basket. We were talking about eggs and baskets in the green room. Now, venture capital trusts are a slightly different animal in that they are a fund. So if you bought a trust, you would be buying a basket of companies. But for a variety of reasons, for a lot of people, EIS is probably a better bet. But you need to actually get that diversification, that portfolio of different businesses. And to get that portfolio of different businesses, you either end up with a huge lever arch file full of different paper and different prospectuses and a whole pile of junk that comes with it, or you actually put your money into a platform and invest it across a portfolio of companies, but you can do it all online, and it just makes life so much easier. If you've got a smartphone, you can see what's going on with your portfolio pretty much at any time, and you can shred all the paper that the regulator seems to insist everybody delivers in triplicate on every single time you... I don't know. I was going to say something rude. But the regulator is very keen that we get lots and lots of paper, and my clients come to me every year and say, do I need to read any of this stuff? And you say, yes, that's the valuation. That's how you've done. That's really all you need to know. So effectively, Kuba fits in here. One part of its role, and we'll come on to the other part of its role after the break, is to provide technology that enables somebody to diversify their EIS holdings between a range of different businesses and see them all in one place and just make life a lot more straightforward. And with that happy news, we will move to a little tune that Dermot chose. Oh, and as dulcet tones of Freddie Mercury, the late, great Freddie Mercury, fade away, Dermot sheds a little tear because he is a huge Queen fan. Well, there you go. It's a little bit he didn't know. Now, we were talking about EIS earlier in the show with Dermot Campbell from Cuba, and I made the point, which is a valid point, that EIS is investment into direct companies. But the direct investment into companies throws up a real problem for the average punter, in that you've got to do this huge amount of due diligence and understand what's going on. And Dermot was saying, just before we came on air, if you actually pick a company where the principal is not that interested in moving it forward, it's just a lifestyle business, which is how I used to run Facts and Figures. The wife and I ran that from home for 15 years, just enough to educate the kids and keep a roof over our heads before we decided to grow it into a slightly more substantial business. If I'd not made that decision, anybody investing in us would have had an investment in our job, not in our business, which is not really much fun. So there is a key element to, and the second string to Cuba's bow, which is effectively, as Dermot put it off air, inserting a fund manager layer into EIS investment. So Dermot, unpack that a bit for us. How does that work? Tell me about what Cuba does and why it does it like it does it.
So investing in unlisted companies is an enormously skillful job. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated. You've got to really understand the business. And you've got to make sure that that business is doing what you want it to do as an investor.
Mm-hmm.
For example, businesses invariably don't work out how much money they need up front. They invariably need more money later.
Yeah.
And if you don't follow on your investment, somebody else will, and they will destroy your investment by diluting you.
Yeah.
So what the best way of doing it, so if you're a professional investor and you've got lots of money, that's great. You can follow on and you know what you're doing and you'll work with the CEO to make sure the business is working the right way. And that's what angels do, angel investors do.
Yeah.
If you're not an experienced angel investor, you need to invest through a fund because you need a venture capital fund manager there who's going to look after that investment for you. It's a very active job. They will tend to sit on the board of the company. They will definitely be working very hard with the chief executive to make sure that company is moving in the direction that they want it to move,
mm-hmm.
And make sure that it's not a lifestyle business. There are lots of businesses out there which are lifestyle businesses, and you're absolutely right. It's nice for you as a business owner to get an investment. It's not great if you're an investor, and then you get stuck there having to wait for 15 years until the kids are educated.
Yeah. A couple of terms that Dermot used that one or two listeners might need a little bit of explanation. Dilution, that's a lovely technical phrase that we financial advisors bandy about all too easily. And when I'm listening, I can hear the things that trot out of our mouths, and other people here do it to me. So we're all in the same boat here. But by dilution, if you've got a business worth, let's say, £100,000 and you issue 100,000 £1 shares, then you've got a business worth £100,000 and your share's worth £1. If the business doesn't grow fast and doesn't improve its value and you need to raise another £100,000, all of a sudden you've got 200,000 £1 shares and a company's still worth £1. Your £1 share that was worth £1 is now worth 50p. It's been diluted by the second tranche of money that came in behind it. And you need to watch that out. The other one that Dermot mentioned was angel investors. And angel investors, it's a lovely phrase. It's used to pamper and encourage rich people to put money in, and everybody wants to be an angel. Being an angel is a nice thing. It's rather better than being an investment devil. I don't know what an investment devil is, but a business angel is somebody who comes along with a wad of cash and chucks it into the business. I mean, effectively, Dragon's Den is four business angels sitting in a room saying, impress me enough that I'm going to put some money in your business and I will take a stake in the value of your business in exchange for my investment. And between my money and expertise and the contacts I may or may not be able to bring to your business may move forward. And it's all about effectively developing smaller businesses into larger businesses, driving employment, driving productivity, the buzzword of 2017-18, and effectively growing the economy. So effectively, Cooper's got two strands to its business, this electronic platform that puts a number of EIS investments in one place on a website so you can see all your investments in one place at one time, and fund management arm, effectively. You call it a fund management arm?
What happens is that your client will invest some money into, will allocate some money to an EIS portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
That money will go onto the platform and they will choose, or you will choose for them, four or five investment managers.
Yeah.
So the four or five investment managers will be handed their share of that money and they will go out and find four or five investments each. So your client will end up with 25 or 30 investments in total, about five from each different manager.
Now, this is quite crucial because I had the slight misconception before we started this conversation that you needed bucket loads of cash to start playing in the EIS market. But in point of fact, your average minimum single investment is only £1,000. Only £1,000. So effectively, to have a sensibly diversified portfolio of the sort that Dermot has just mentioned, you only need about £30,000 to play.
That's correct.
Now, the key point, financial advisor in me says, you probably only want to put about 10% of your overall wealth into EIS because it is a relatively high-risk investment. But in point of fact, we've got quite a lot on risk in this section, because risk is widely misunderstood. Everybody tells you that crossing the road is a really safe activity. And it is. But every day, someone somewhere in the UK or Europe gets knocked down by a car crossing the road. For them, it weren't that safe. So what it effectively means is safety is there is a low probability of something bad happening to you. Risk is that probability becomes a bit higher. But there are lots and lots of different sorts of risks. And if you've got all your money linked to the UK stock market, for the sake of argument, and the UK stock market comes off by 20%, then you've just lost 20% of your money. And what you really want is a portfolio of investments in lots of different asset classes, and EIS is an asset class, that are, in the technical jargon, non-correlated. And for the non-mathematicians amongst us, non-correlated means if you've got an investment in an umbrella company and an investment in an ice cream company, in the summertime, the ice cream company is doing pretty well, but nobody wants to buy umbrellas. So effectively, the two companies perform diametrically opposite to each other according to the seasons. It's a very simplistic example, but different economic conditions impact on different types of businesses in different ways at different times. But you get the idea. If you've got, I don't know, a holding in O2 and a holding in Vodafone, they're both technology mobile phone businesses. They're both, broadly speaking, going to be impacted by the same things in the market. And those shares will probably move, absent major business events in that individual company's life, broadly in line with each other. They will be a highly correlated asset. But the umbrella company and the ice cream company, directly non-correlated assets. And the key thing for EIS investors, which is not widely understood and ought to be because it's important, is that EIS is not directly correlated to the UK stock market. If the UK stock market goes off 20%, it's very unlikely to drag down your EIS investment in the same way.
Well, it won't, because they perform in a completely different way.
So talk about that a bit more.
So with an EIS, you invest your money.
Yeah.
You put it in and you agree a valuation at the beginning, which you decide which you invest on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got no idea what it's worth for really quite a long time. So you assume it's worth what you put in. And then something happens and somebody decides they're going to buy the business.
Yeah.
And hopefully they pay more than you paid in the first place.
Mm.
And you get your money back.
Yeah.
And so what happened in the middle in terms of the financial markets is irrelevant.
It's a journey for that individual company, which is not directly affected by outside markets. If you've got a business in the right place, I mean, people who invested in Uber, people who invested in one or two of the tech startups that have done really rather well. I'm thinking, what's the room one? The name's gone. Neither of us can think of it.
Deliveries and other
examples. There's several businesses that have started from nothing with very little and have actually gone from nowhere to quite a large market valuation and a really nice cash return for investors.
And you're talking about unicorns, of course.
Yeah. Yes, because they are a little rare. But it's nice when they happen. Okay, so we said in this section we'd look at the macroeconomic angle of EIS, and spreadsheet fills budget was a game changer, you said.
I mean, it really was.
Why?
The great problem is that there was all this tax incentive to invest in EIS, and that's been around since 1993. It's not easy, but there was tax incentives to put money into EIS.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's relatively easy. It's not relatively easy, but you can grow that EIS until it gets to a bit bigger, till it gets from the S to the M of SME or small to medium-sized enterprises. There used to be a problem at that point because it's still very difficult to raise money for a medium-sized enterprise as well. Once you get large, then you can go to the main stock market and raise your money that way. But until you get there, it's quite difficult to bridge that gap. Now, what the budget did, which nobody's really talked about, is introduced a £20 billion stimulus to encourage investment in the medium-sized enterprises. And that is very, very, very good news.
That's proper money. 20 billion quid
is a lot of dosh. Money. Yeah.
So how do we get hold of some of that? Tell me, because I'm interested.
Well, so I will tell you exactly how you do it. Very easy. Invest in EIS and VCTs.
Yeah.
Those companies will grow, and then they will get to the sort of the slightly bigger stage, and then you hand them over to somebody else to take them on to the next stage. And that 20 billion is there to take over at the end of the EIS point. So what it will do is it will drive the valuations of exiting EIS, or it will encourage new investors to come in alongside the existing investors to help that grow that company up to the next stage.
So where's this $20 billion coming from? Is the government, I was going to say privatising, the opposite, taking into state ownership a load of enterprises by chucking $20 billion in the market?
What they're doing is they're creating a fund.
Right.
And through the British Business Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And they're putting money into this fund. And this fund is going to, and that fund will be match funding other investments.
Right.
And they're going to make a series of investments with that fund, which are going to grow. And then they're going to sell the fund off in pieces. So they'll turn it, they'll unitize it, in other words, break it up into lots of little bits,
yeah,
bite-sized chunks, and they will sell it on to institutional pensions and people like that, for them to go and benefit from the...
And then they've got to pile more cash and they can reinvest it and do the whole thing.
But exactly.
They've got a $20 yep. billion float to start with.
But what we've seen is since 1987, we've seen institutional investors divesting from venture capital, venture capital being investment in small to medium-sized enterprises. And they've now pretty much completely divested. They've got nothing left at all in it.
Well, it's all about the risk, the management of risk, isn't it? Because, I mean, to some degree, the Bank of yep. England, well, the government via the Bank of England, have effectively said, you bankers have been playing too much in the casino with other people's money, so go yep. back to being a high street bank, concentrate on your knitting, and don't back small yep. companies.
And also what's happened is we've seen seen a long period of globalization where we've seen an increasing drive of share values through this globalization process, which has been part of that divesting out of venture capital into big global businesses. Those big global businesses are now kind of, in my view, got to a peak. And we've seen lots of people. We saw Neil Woodford talking about that, saying that that's created a massive opportunity. But all the major institutional investors have been concentrating on that. And what the government is trying to do is to persuade them to stop doing that and actually start to invest back into SMEs again.
Yeah, because there is a distinct difference between shorting companies in the stock market or buying dodgy mortgage books or whatever, which really is casino operation, and actually making a bona fide investment in a growth business that actually is good for the community, it's good for jobs, it's good for UK PLC, and good for everybody.
Exactly. I can't remember what the actual statistics are, but it's something like 75% of the population is employed by SMEs.
Well, absolutely. I mean, my own company, Facts and Figures, we've got 20 people in the business. We've gone yep. from being mom and pop on our own with a girl, who, by the way, is still with us,
right.
to, you know, we've got 20 people in the business and we have an eye on further development if we can.
Yep.
I should imagine Cooper's the same.
We've got 15 at Cooper at the moment,
yep.
and we plan to grow that to about 60 over the next 2 years.
Well, that's a fairly aggressive development. We'll have to compare notes on our development plan.
We will.
I struggle to see how I'm going to get to 60 in 2 years, but it would be nice if we could. Okay, so effectively, the government is really funding the other end, which is in putting liquidity into the EIS market, because there are two or three things that may encourage, worry or concern people slightly when they're looking at EIS. One is the idea of the fact that smaller companies are inherently risky. And we've already said
yep.
you can do two things. One, there is a risk of not being in the small company market because you need the diversification.
Yep.
Two is you can mitigate that risk by diversifying within your smaller
yep.
company holdings, and you can spread those around. So you've dealt with that. But then the next issue is liquidity, because, of course, while in order to keep your tax relief, you've got to stay into an EIS for 3 years, there is a serious possibility that you'll be hard-pressed to get your money back at the three-year stage. You're more likely to get it back, I think we were saying, at about the seven-year stage.
Well, yeah.
Or something in between.
Recently, a new coin of phrase is patient capital.
It's a good phrase, that. I looked it up on the internet. I've heard it for the first time in a budget.
Yep. So patient capital is investments which you have to be patient for.
Yeah.
And the important thing here is that most people don't need to spend all of their money all at the same time.
No, they don't.
Most people probably don't want to spend their money for really quite a long time.
Yeah.
A lot of their money for really quite a long time.
Mm.
And so they've coined this new phrase, patient capital. With an EIS, what will happen, you'll invest in a portfolio. There'll be 30 investments in that portfolio. You'll get a few. You may get one out a bit early. You'll lose your tax relief, but you'll be happy because it did really well. A few will fail. That's fact.
Mm.
But in years four and five, some will exit. In years six and seven, more will exit. And by the time you get to year eight, you'll be probably left with a handful which are going to hang around for a bit longer.
Okay.
So that's how it works.
Okay. Well, I think we've got quite a bit more to cover, but I think it's probably time for a break. I can feel an advert coming on, and then a little bit more Queen.
If you need expert financial advice you can both understand and trust on your savings and investments, retirement planning, equity release or life and health insurance, talk to the experts at Facts and Figures Chartered Financial Planners. Phone 01233 722 922 or check them out at www.fffp.co.uk. Facts and Figures, independent financial advice everyone can follow. www.fffp.co.uk.
jobsinkent.com.
Oh, and there Freddie disappears again. I do love that Brian May guitar riff. The way he does that is just spectacular. I like that one. And it's actually moderately easy to play.
Big
but anyway,
favourite of mine, but I can't play.
Well, I can, but very badly. Never mind. You're listening to Money Talk. We're live on Channel Radio on Friday. Tuesday, repeat, we'll not be live, but there you go. It's a bit like listening to... oh, dear, I was about to go for an example and I can't find it now, so I shall forget what I was going to say. I'm here with Dermot Campbell. We're talking all things Enterprise Investment Scheme, EIS for short. And in point of fact, and I don't think we can overmake this point, what Philip Hammond said in the budget really was a massive game changer, wasn't it? Because it just so incentivized the market and de-risked the back end in a very significant way, that effectively it's really putting a big pointer to anybody who's thinking about how do I invest my money for the medium to longer term. EIS actually becomes a serious option because you can see the government is really serious about making that money work, making that market and that money work properly.
It really is. The $20 billion stimulus which he brought in will be an enormous game changer. And what's particularly clever was it's not even his money.
How so?
Because the plan is to co-invest. So the plan is to persuade other people to invest.
Yeah.
And it's a very strong incentive because if you're putting money into a fund, and somebody, if you're putting your money into a fund and somebody else is putting the same amount of money into the investment, there's half the risk.
Yeah.
You're sharing the problem.
And the government's half of it. So you can be reasonably sensible that the government's involved. There is sort of this implied error of safety and what's the word? Safety and sophistication and legitimacy.
Exactly.
Government
and
involvement
never rejects legitimacy.
Yes, Dermot had his fingers crossed when he said that, and I nearly choked, but we both know what you mean. The governments don't make mistakes, but they do have to be careful with public money, and they are generally reasonably sensible, unless they're doing IT projects. But we won't talk about that. So I'm a punter, I've got some money, and I'm thinking, all right, I've listened to Money Talk, and you've sort of got me vaguely interested in EIS. What do I do? How does it work? How do we get started on this?
So what's it really important? And I'm going to come back to the example you used earlier on of the ice cream and of Vodafone and O2.
Mm.
There are two types of investment risk in this world.
Mm.
There is specific investment risk. And if we look at the ice cream parlor versus the umbrella stand, if it doesn't rain, you're probably not going to sell any umbrellas.
Yep.
But you might still sell ice cream. And if it's not sunny, people might not buy ice cream. So they've got two individual specific risks. Because
In a bad summer, you might not sell much ice cream. In a mild winter, you might not sell any umbrellas. So the umbrella company or the thing can be affected by specific weather risks.
Correct.
Specific to that.
Exactly.
Okay. And then you've got the systemic risk,
which is where risk which links things together.
Mm-hmm.
And the example you used earlier on was O2. Maybe some big macro change that people banned mobile phones.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Both O2 and Vodafone would be very seriously impacted by that.
Mm. I can't knock it because I live in a rural area where there is no landline broadband, and I've just bought myself a 4G router. And a 4G router at home actually means I can download television programs for the first time in 3 years.
Fantastic.
Oh, it's wonderful. So I'm a big fan of 4G at the moment. But anyway, so that's systemic risk. If something adversely affects, if somebody blew up all the transformers, if somebody blew up all the transmitters, both O2 and Vodafone would be in trouble. And that's a systemic risk.
Exactly.
So you can
protect against specific risks by diversifying, investing in lots of different things.
Yeah.
Systemic risks, there's frankly nothing you can do about.
Other than try and make sure that not all your investments are affected by the same system.
Yeah.
Which is why you might want to hold EIS so that you avoid the systemic risks associated with the UK stock market.
Correct.
Hey, you see, we're on the same page here.
Exactly. So most of EIS are small companies, and they are really all about specific risks.
Yeah.
And the way you deal with specific risks is by diversifying.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a mathematical formula which you can do, and those mathematicians of you out there will remember at school that pretty little bell curve you get, which shows that it's called the normal distribution curve.
Yeah.
So if you invest in one thing, you're a little bit more likely to get a medium outcome and a little bit less likely to get an extreme outcome, like lose everything or make billions.
Yeah.
But if you invest in 10 things the same, you're less likely to get the extreme outcomes because the successes will cancel out the failures, and your bell curve gets a little bit steeper in the middle. But if you invest in 30, and this is what we talk about in venture capital terms, you're looking for 3 successful investments out of 30. Is what you're looking for.
Really?
So you
only need to get 3 successful ones out of 30 to make this work.
Yep. But that's more likely to get 3 in 30 than you are to get 1 in 10.
Yeah, you are.
So, you will get 3 failures that's, well, you might not, but you probably will get three failures and you probably will get three successes. And then everything else in the middle will be a bit mediocre.
Yeah.
Some will make a bit, some will lose a bit, but it'll balance out. And, of course, you get all of the tax relief on top of that as well. So the important thing is that you rule out... So you do, by building a portfolio, you do rule out the chance of getting a really outstanding sort of 20 times your money return. You're not going to get that out of a portfolio. You might out of a single investment, but you might lose it all as well. But equally with a portfolio, you're unlikely to get a catastrophic loss as well. It's unlikely that a group of professional managers are going to get
everything wrong.
30 decisions.
Even a professional fund manager will get something right occasionally.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's what we're all about. So we're about trying to make sure people get the medium return, and that's sort of hopefully 1.5 to 2 times your money over a period of 5, 6, or 7 years.
Which is not a bad return at all, and if the way it averages out, that's still a decent return on your overall £30,000, particularly
exactly.
On £30,000 net of 30% income tax relief, and perhaps a chunk of capital gains holdover. So it's very 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 attractive. Okay, so effectively the story goes: I've got, let's pretend, I wish £300,000, and we say, okay, I've got 90% of that invested traditionally in a diverse portfolio of mainstream open-ended investment companies, OEICs, maybe some ISAs, bits and pieces, traditional funds, largely invested in the FTSE and corporate bonds and other mainstream asset classes.
Yep.
But to diversify my risk and ensure that I don't take on the whole systemic risk of that section of the market, it's probably appropriate for me to consider putting 10% of that money into something that is not correlated with that market, something that's a bit more diversified. And so I might say, right, I've got £30,000 and I'm prepared to invest in EIS.
That's
my
right.
Financial advisor will sit me down and say, is this something that you feel comfortable about? Go away and think about it for a few days. Make sure that you're comfortable.
Yep.
Talk to your partner, because if they're not both on the side, it doesn't work. And once you've had that sort of conversation, you broadly speak, you say, okay, I've got 30 grand. So, we've looked at the fact that Cooper's got a platform and it's worth playing with. So financial advisor and client sitting there with 30 grand in their hand, what do we do next?
Yep. So you'll sit down as a financial advisor with your client and you'll talk him through that 30,000. You'll talk to him about the tax benefits of it, and he gets income tax, he gets capital gains tax, and he gets inheritance tax benefits.
Yeah.
That's an important thing we didn't mention earlier.
No, absolutely.
You will choose a group of fund managers for him.
Yeah.
With him.
Yeah.
And those fund managers will be doing all sorts of interesting things. You'll probably choose some who are making some films. You'll probably choose some who are doing some technology. You might choose some who are investing in restaurants. You might choose some which are investing in life science, which is trying to get the latest cure for cancer or whatever it happens to be.
Or antibiotic resistance or whatever.
Antibiotic resistance is another flavor feature, which we've got several investments on the platform doing that.
I like that one.
So you'll end up with an eclectic group of investments. They will be doing all sorts of random things. Mm. You might have some consumer brands in there. And then what will happen is that you'll sit there and maybe in the first 3 years, you'll get lucky and one of the tech investments will have sold very quickly and done really well. You'll lose your tax relief, but that's okay because...
You've had a really good return.
You've had a good outcome.
Because to keep your tax relief, you've got to hold the investment for 3 years.
You have.
So if your investment actually cashes out in the first 3 years, you have to give your tax relief back. But if you've got a really good return, you're ahead of the game and you don't care. So that's fine.
Correct.
So let's hope you pick a really good tech company and you made a decent return. You didn't need your tax relief. But it's only on that element. It's not on the whole investment,
exactly.
Which is a crucial point.
But what's also going to happen is there's probably going to be a couple of failures in that first 3 years.
Nobody likes to talk about those.
Nobody likes to talk about them, but they're a fact of life. And what will be happening is that you'll be having a discussion with your client saying, well, we got this portfolio of 30. Three of them are probably going to go bust. I wonder which ones they are.
Mm.
And you'll be looking at them and seeing, well, that one's looks a bit dodgy. Mm. Lo and behold, maybe that one fails.
Mm.
What happens then is your client then gets more tax relief on that failure. So
now, how does that work? Because I missed that bit.
He gets something called loss
relief. Yes, of course.
Yeah. And the loss relief means if he's a 45% taxpayer, in fact, let's talk about 40% taxpayers because there are much more of those.
Yeah.
As a 40% taxpayer, add up the initial tax relief and the loss relief, and he'll actually get just under 60p in the pound back from his investment. So the disasters are not actually that disastrous.
Because the loss relief gives you a cushion.
Exactly.
So you almost want the odd one to fail because it sweetens the pot, but maybe not. But yeah,
well,
okay.
You probably don't. But and if you get one which you only get 40p back from, for example, you still get loss relief on the loss. So
it comes out in the wash quite nicely.
It does. So then you'll continue on, and in year four, then there'll be a couple of successes, hopefully. And that's probably the point. Years four or five is probably the point where you get the really good ones come out.
Okay.
They'll be the what's called the home runs. They might give you, what we call a 5x or five times your money back, maybe a bit more.
Well, that'd be nice.
And then it'll trundle on, and year five and six and seven, you'll start to get more exits, but they will be the disappointing, not so good exits.
Yeah.
7, 8, 9, most of the portfolio is going to have been sold, but you're going to have those three problem children left who you could be stuck with for really quite a long time. What you'll have been doing with your client, of course, along the way, is you'll be saying, as they exit, you'll have been saying, well, do you want to spend that? Not really. You'll reinvest, you'll get some more tax relief, and this portfolio will take on a life of its own. So it'll be continually changing, you'll be continually developing it, and hopefully it'll give you a really good long-term return.
Very nice too. Now, in order to get the tax relief, remind me, do I actually had to have paid tax in the first place?
You certainly have to have owed tax,
right?
So you may not have to have paid it. You can get it against income tax in the current year,
yeah,
or you can have it treated as though you made the investment in the previous tax year.
Yeah.
And you can get it against any capital gain which you paid in the last 3 years. You get to what's called defer that tax. So what happens is that you sold a property 3 years ago. Maybe you made a £20,000 or £30,000 profit out of that. You would have paid your 28% capital gains tax. You invest it in that £30,000 into an EIS, and you will and you get that tax back until you sell the EIS. And then the gain is treated as though it arose in that year when you sold the EIS, which is quite handy because you get another £11,000 capital gains tax allowance.
Thank you very much indeed. Ka-ching. Well, you know what? I think I might fancy an EIS myself after that. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking all things EIS with Dermot Campbell from Cuba Ventures. Effectively, EIS, a sensible thing to consider if you've got a bit of cash knocking about because the government really, really wants you to invest in small businesses. So until next week, this is Simon Webster. It's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from Dermot.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening and we'll speak to you again live at 1 o'clock Friday next week. Goodbye.
If you need expert financial advice you can both understand and trust on your savings and investments, retirement planning, equity release or life and health insurance, talk to the experts at Facts and Figures Chartered Financial Planners. Phone 01233 722 922 or check them out at www.fffp.co.uk. Facts and Figures, independent financial advice everyone can follow. www.fffp.co.uk.
You've gone through the trauma of losing a spouse and you've lost that tax break, it's effectively a tax on death, and that's not good news. Offshore trusts, they've introduced some anti-avoidance rules. The government will introduce new anti-avoidance rules that relate to the taxation of income and gains accruing to offshore trusts. This measure ensures that payments from an offshore trust intended for a UK resident individual do not escape tax when they are made via an overseas beneficiary or a remittance basis user. The changes introduced by this measure will have effect on and after April 2018. Now, actually, this is quite important because there are a lot of people avoiding tax legally using offshore trusts, but by tightening the rules, they will make that sort of practice evasion, and that will be good news. So it will no longer possible to park your money offshore and say, you can't tax me, it's not UK income. They're playing with pensions tax registration, but I shouldn't think anybody listening is going to care. Lifetime allowance. Now, this has gone up from £1 million to £1,030,000, as I mentioned earlier. What it does mean is if you time your withdrawals and wait until the indexation has gone through after the 6th of April 2018, you could save a significant amount of tax. This has got to be good news. The starting rate for savers, 0% tax for starting rate for savers, will be retained at its current value of £5,000 during 2018 and 19 and will not be uprated in line with inflation. The measure applies to the whole of the UK. It's a nice round figure. Why mess with it? It does kind of make cash ISAs redundant, unless you've got a lot of money, but it's certainly very useful. £5,000 worth of income exempt from on your savings, exempt from tax altogether. There's going to be a consultation paper in 2018 to see how the general taxation of UK-based UK-based trusts can be made fairer, more transparent, and a little bit more straightforward.